I am here with John McWhorter. John, thanks for joining me again.
Of course. Good to be here.
So it's been, I think it's been 4 years. I checked my own website and that's what it said to me. We spoke about your book, Woke Racism. Is that when that came out, about 4 years ago?
That would have been in 21. Mm-hmm. That's right. Or maybe early 22. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we first did it in 2020, didn't we?
I think you've been on the podcast twice. Yeah.
During the Troubles was our first one. Yeah.
Well, how are the Troubles? Have the Troubles continued? Where are we in the... your side of the culture war?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think that there was a peak woke nationwide, which now looks blissfully quaint. You know, some of the reasons for the defenestration, some of the double talk, what I wrote Woke Racism to be part of the resistance against, that's another era. But from what I've seen, a lot of academia and a lot of the arts are possibly ruined for the duration, because there's no way of uprooting it from those places, especially since it emerged so much from there. And to tell you the truth, that way of thinking...
We got to double click on that, or at least make sure you get back to it. I want to know how the damage has been truly unrecoverable, or not unrecoverable quickly in your view.
Oh, I would just say that, especially if you are an academic or a certain kind of journalist, and maybe an artist, you see yourself as having a unique kind of insight for one thing. You think that you have discovered a truth rather than you have an opinion, and you don't recognize yourself in that description. And you have authority to pass on a way of thinking, not so much to undergrads, that gets exaggerated, but to graduate students who then become professors themselves, as long as they aren't white men. And you have what you decide a conference is going to be about. You have what you decide is going to be your cocktail party conversation, and it gets passed along, and it's hard for me to see how that ideology won't continue to affect hirings. And so already there are people of that ideology with gray hair, and I can't imagine what the pathway would be that would change it. Now, I also may lack imagination, but being, frankly, around that culture, the sorts of things that I hear regularly said, the sorts of assumptions, the assumptions about who gets hired and what kind of student is admitted to a program, that's a tough one to see. I don't see how the toothpaste gets back into the tube. So in society in general...
Wait a minute. Isn't DEI getting reamed out of all the institutions right now by Trumpist minions?
Officially, but from what I see, it's just going to go underground. The idea is not going to be that we can't do these things. The idea is going to be, how can we do these sorts of things and keep up the regime without calling it DEI, without being so overt about it? And if it really could be that, you know, the Trump world, which I frankly have pitiless disregard for, but if it could be that there's a socio-historical accident where their actions actually changed matters, that would make sense to me. But I lack the imagination to see how it won't just make people change labels. Because after all, DEI largely is a euphemism for affirmative action and racial preferences. That was a new way of doing those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So it'll just be the same stuff, old wine in new bottles. Maybe I am pessimistic because it's a slate gray January day in Manhattan, but that's the way I've been feeling lately.
Well, what's your current vantage point on this? Are you still teaching at Columbia?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And
are you part of the hiring machinery at all? Do you go to meetings where you make those decisions? Or
actually, no. Like if for some reason somebody was going to make a movie about me, one of the fictions would be that I would be serving on tenure committees, et cetera. I actually have a very eccentric position at Columbia where the linguistics program is tiny. It's not a department. It's only two full-time people. And the two of us are ensconced within Slavic and largely left alone. And so I am in very few meetings. I serve on very few committees. I lead a double life as Columbia professor, and as you know, now writing for the New York Times. So I don't see it, but I certainly hear about it, and I certainly read about it. And I do have certain things that I'm asked to do where you can see what the climate is. Now, of course, there are contrarians. It's not that every professor on campus is of that kind, but that kind of professor does have quite an influence over departments. I think undergraduates are often more skeptical than we think, but it's everything else but them, which is what the school is.
There was recently an article that, was it in Compact Magazine? I read it, I forgot
James
the author's
Haskins,
name.
I think his name. Haskins was his last
name. He was detailing the pattern of hiring going back, I don't know how many years, maybe, you know, 20 years or so, but in academia and in media and in Hollywood. I don't know, I'm sure there's been an effort to debunk some of those numbers, but the pattern was detailed there, at least in the article. It was pretty stark with respect to just how relentlessly white men in particular had been filtered against in all of these high status areas.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to step on any toes, but I want to also say something real. For example, another way that I moonlight is that I teach music humanities at Columbia, and that's the course where what it really is the old school music appreciation course, the idea being that unless you have a very weird ear or a very weird experience, Beethoven at first, other than da-da-da-da, it's boring. You're sitting there, the symphony goes on and on, yeah. It's not as easy. So our job, you know,
it's less boring than Clockwork Orange, but it can be boring.
Yeah. And our job is to teach kids how to at least halfway appreciate a music that isn't always easy to enjoy. And let's face it, for reasons we all understand, 99% of it was written by white men until about 10 minutes ago. So I've been doing that course, and I therefore follow the music teaching and musicology world to an extent. And there is a guy who I am sure is a nice person in real life. His name is Philip Ewell, and he is a black musicologist who has taken the music study world by storm ever since, you know, the troubles in 2020, with this idea that music theory is inherently racist. And I'm going to avoid getting into the weeds of why that idea doesn't make sense, but it doesn't make any more sense than it sounds. Mm. And I think anybody who was exposed to the article and then the book that he wrote on its basis fully understands that whatever else his accomplishments are, from what I know, he speaks Russian fluently, et cetera. But this idea that music theory is racist, it's just, it's absurd. It's frankly absurd.
Well, people have said that math is racist, right?
So math too, and you know, learning classical languages. But he's also saying that Beethoven was just, you know, just okay. He was maybe above average, but that he's lionized too much, you know, because he's white. This man is being treated like Ibram Kendi was 5 years ago. You know, he speaks in one department after another with a certain kind of person sitting there pretending that it makes sense. I hate to say that about somebody, but I had to choose one person. And that sort of thing, you know, where there is this impulse to pretend that something like that is true, which then is also affecting certain curricular decisions. That's what I have a hard time seeing going away, but I might lack optimism. How do you feel?
Well, I really don't have a point of view or a practical, you know, insight into any of this. I just have a lot of hope that we reached a tipping point some, you know, a couple of years ago. And I mean, probably the abject failure of Kamala Harris's attempt to become president with its apotheosis being her inability to disavow her former support for taxpayer-funded gender reassignment surgery for incarcerated illegal immigrants. That was the moment where I felt that the political liability of these far-left shibboleths and the inability to just reason from some common sense principles, I just felt that it became so excruciating and so unpragmatic politically, that I just have to hope that that was the high watermark and things are quickly recalibrating in millions of brains and have been ever since. But I really don't have any direct, I certainly don't have any direct insight within the ivory tower about this. I have a daughter who will be going to college in, you know, hopefully in a year, but I'm in the strange situation of not even knowing where I would hope she would get in, given what you, the noises I've just heard you make. So exactly. What's your view of that moment for, I don't know how old your kids are, but where would you hope they go to get a proper education in the liberal arts or anything at this moment?
Well, it's coming. One of mine is 13. I think certainly high woke has been shown that it can't get a significant amount of votes, certainly that. But in terms of the culture, what I see, honestly, Sam, is that in 2020, and it had been a few years before that, but it peaks in 2020 and 2021, there is this ideology that is based on resisting reason in place of this eternal battle against essentially whiteness. And the idea that it's okay to be punitive in order to make sure that everybody stands in line. No longer is that happening on the basis of, say, black men and the police. But frankly, and what I did see up close, unfortunately, because of what happened at Columbia and then spread, is that the way a certain kind of person is given to talking about what Hamas did, and also the way a certain kind of person is given to talking about trans issues when it comes especially to issues of surgery and sports, there's that same fury, that same tribal punitive idea, the same absolute resistance to any facts that someone tries to bring up. And so to me, it's kind of like, I'm a little under the weather, and so I'm grasping for the analogy that the thing with gophers, you keep on, you get rid of the gopher in one hole, and then it comes up another hole. I don't know whether they actually do that, but I feel like that same woke ideology is just now being applied to different issues, and it will keep being applied to certain issues. It's just this flame that never quite goes out.
Mm. Well, what can we do? I mean, is there something for us to do that we haven't tried at this point? I mean, you and in our various orbits, I mean, there are some dozens of people I could name, I think, who, at least to my eye, have their heads screwed on straight in precisely the way I think we do, and are, you know, outdoor cats sufficiently so as to resist the pressures of conformity within media when talking about this kind of stuff. And we're in a position to, you know, badger our podcast guests and, you know, write opinion pieces. And I mean, you're over there at the New York Times. You really are within the castle in at least two respects, being at Columbia too. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you're not doing that in the dead of night you think maybe you should be doing, or if you had more allies, you could be doing?
I consider it my duty to just repeat over and over that what all of these dust-ups have in common is this rather peculiar idea that battling power differentials must be the central goal of any kind of academic or artistic or judicial endeavor. It's that rather mundane-seeming thing that can take you from the George Floyd protests to, you know, the kids all but supporting what Hamas did out of an idea that that was the right thing to do because Israel is quote-unquote white and imposed upon the region by whiteness. It's that again and again. And, you know, it has to be like Madison Avenue. You can't say something once and expect there to be any kind of effect. Mm. You have to just keep at it for years and years and years. I think my job is just to keep at that, because the idea is to understand what the general pattern is, not to shake your fist at the particulars of each one. I just see the same thing happening over and over. And so there's that. And do I feel that I haven't done something? Maybe in that. You even saw, if we're going to talk about how the sausage is made to an extent. It took a while before I came on your show in 2020, because I always said, I want to read my books. I have other stuff to do. I don't feel like, you know, being on podcasts. And then I realized I'm becoming an antique. It wasn't you personally. It was just, I'm becoming an antique not to speak as well as to write. There's a part of me that thinks that I should be the sort of person who, after woke racism, you know, I had to stop the podcasting after a certain point. I told my publisher I cannot do it again after about 100. Maybe I was supposed to do like 500 shows. Maybe I should have decided that for the next few years, or maybe the next 20, I'm just going to do that message as much as I can, instead of side projects that I do, and instead of at least pretending that I'm still a linguist, etc. Sometimes I think that I'm not doing the job. But the problem, Sam, is that I crave variety, and I wrote Woke Racism in a fury. I continue to stand behind it, but I'm not the kind of person who could just keep doing woke racism again and again and again for 20 years. And maybe I'm a little guilty about it, but not that guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I find it depressing that you even have to talk about race, frankly. I mean, it seems like a massive opportunity cost.
Sometimes it feels that way to me.
Yeah. I mean, that is a bit of an impediment. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. There's something about having to cut through your own boredom with a topic when it seems necessary to touch it again, and you can't even find anything new to say about it. But
And life is short. And so, I mean, luckily, I always think now with modern technology, anything that you did is out there. It's accessible. But let's face it, after a while, it starts falling to the bottom of the pile. Mm. So, I was happy that woke racism did its job. It sold. And I don't sit down and write a book thinking, I want this to make me lots of money and sell. I did that with one book, my book on profanity, 9 nasty words. I thought at the time, I want to have one hit. I'm going to keep writing books, but I'm weird. There's only one thing I have to say where over 100,000 people are going to read it, and it's going to be about cussing. That worked. I didn't know while I was writing that 2020 was going to happen. But I wrote Woke Racism because I thought someone needs to say this who is 1, Black, 2, middle-aged, and 3, writes fast. That happened to be me. And I thought this needs to be out there to say something. And to the extent, and I'm not bragging, this will never happen to me again, but it went over 100, which is much more than I've ever sold of a book. That means that people read it. And I think that, I feel like that was part of doing the job. And the book then just sits there and maybe gets lent. And I did the audio version. But I know that technically I could have kept going and doing more.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of boring you, but edifying our audience, what do you think we got wrong in 2020 in the aftermath of George Floyd's death? I mean, as a country, what if there were some massive error we could have sidestepped culturally, how would you describe that error, and what would a sane dialogue have looked and sounded like at that point?
You mean America or people like you and me?
No, America. I mean, like you know, the Democratic Party, the you know, left of center, intelligentsia, the elites, you know, the New York Times.
You know, the thing that, you know, if I could wave a magic wand and change things, the hardest thing is the idea that black men live in danger of being iced by a white cop who, in a moment of tension, is affected by their inner racism to pull the trigger. And that is an item of faith among a great many people of all levels of education. And it's an absolute third rail. And I have found that again and again in terms of where I could even publish what I just said in writing where anybody would read it, et cetera. And that's not a knock on the Times, because they have let me politely say that now and then, but I write for them every week. But it was much harder before that. And still, it's just that an orthodoxy that if George Floyd had been white, he would still be alive, despite the fact that a very similar thing had happened 4 years before to a very white guy named Tony Timpa, and we never heard anything about it. That one is so hard to cut through, no matter how carefully you make the argument. And so George Floyd was a matter of people really thinking that, say, me, maybe I'm getting a little old for it at 60, but that I walk around in a danger that you don't, because the cops are more likely to kill me. That's a myth. And, you know, the numbers don't support it. It really doesn't work in 2026. That certainly probably was true in 1950, but it's been a while.
Yeah.
We couldn't get past that in 2020 and 2021, and it created an awful lot of what I couldn't help seeing as kabuki, but I know a lot of people really did believe they were fighting against something real. That was the worst thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can lay a lot of the blame on social media and the algorithm and the ability to just amplify, you know, 5-10 awful videos that get burned into people's minds indelibly and seem far more informative of reality than any statistics you can throw at people for context, right? So I think if you ask most people left of center how many innocent black men, how many unarmed black men were gunned down each year by cops in America, you know, they'd be off by one or two orders of magnitude in their estimation. I mean, the few people I've tried this on, it's always worked. I mean, the truth is around 10 or so, 10, 15 of
I've
the-
I've heard maybe, some of them think it's 1,000.
Yeah, people think it's 1,000. I've heard people estimate 10,000. You know, I mean, so three orders of magnitude.
It's not funny, sorry.
And yeah, so anyway, this is a longer discussion that I've had several times, both with myself on my podcast at great length and with other guests. I'm sure you and I ran around this track last time 4 years ago. You have a very long-running discussion with your friend Glenn Lowry, who's been on the podcast here several times. Is there any daylight between you guys on this or any kind of adjacent topic? How does your conversation with Glenn evolve here?
Glenn and I felt the exact same way about 20 and 21, although Glenn gets madder at people who are caught up in things like that than I do. I think one of my major themes is that you learn the language you grow up hearing. And a lot of the people who were breaking windows, a lot of the people who were, you know, refusing to give into sense about black men and the cops, or so ready to believe that somebody like Alton Blake was an angel when in fact he turned out to be a thug and Kamala Harris is right at his bedside and things like that. And thug as in what he did, was it Blake? Yes. And what he did was absolutely egregious and violent, and yet everybody believed the original story. Glenn gets mad, whereas I think I would think that way too if I were caught up in their situation, including even educated people who think that, you know, 1,000 black men are gunned down, because that feels good. You're thinking, if I believe that and refuse to squint and think about how unlikely that is, then I am a good person because I am sticking up for battling differentials of power, and especially white power. So we have that. Of late, one thing that has opened up between him and me is that he is much more, I hate to call it pro-Palestinian, but he condemns Israel more than I found myself able to. Yeah. And the one time that we had a discussion where at the end of it, you know, after we went off, we were saying, are we okay? Was because of that. And it was Ta-Nehisi Coates' book and us discussing it. And Glenn loved the book. And it used to be that he was the one that would be cussing about Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Oh, I missed that episode. We're going to have to see that.
He can't help it. It was a good one. But Glenn liked the book, and frankly, I thought it was the devil's spawn. And so we have kind of stopped talking about that. And also, and this is something where I genuinely, I don't get it. And I would say that if Glenn were right here, and we laugh about it. Glenn finds Trump tolerable.
Yeah.
He thinks that that's who we elected and don't have the Trump derangement syndrome. Whereas I personally think that his election was a catastrophe that shows that there's something very wrong with the country and our procedures. And I truly, you know, I don't think I'm deranged, but I think that he's just an utter excrescence. And we have trouble with that. But a lot of our audience feel the way Glenn does. And a lot of our audience wish I would just go away because I guess I seem like I'm looking down on them by thinking of Trump as a near simian human being. And I can imagine how they feel. I get it, but I can't help expressing the way I feel. So there's been that, especially lately.
Well, I'll have to watch your argument with Glenn around Israel and Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Oh, that got around. Yeah.
So it sounds like you and I are totally aligned on those topics, Trump and distinguishing support for Hamas and any other sane political conviction. But I mean, this is a meme in my brain that I don't quite know what to do with. So I'm very concerned about the global rise of anti-Semitism that we've all witnessed since October 7th. And I view it as just a threat to open societies generally. I view, jihadism and Islamism as that threat. I mean, I've spoken about that for now a quarter of a century. And I just view that the predicament that Israel's in, we can talk about the marginalia around Netanyahu and the empowering of the far right in Israel and the other political missteps.
Which I have major problems with, I'm sure you do.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not going to defend any of that. But generally speaking, they're a kind of canary in the coal mine and sitting at the front line of what I view as a civilizational clash between open societies and at least one form of their genuine enemy, which is, jihadism and its larger political project. And so my view about anti-Semitism and what to do about it is, generally speaking, not to focus on it and certainly not to practice Jewish identity politics in defense against it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think we have to get out of the identity business. I think we need to figure out how to create open societies for human beings to live in liberal, tolerant, pluralistic contexts where, human rights and political equality or master values, et cetera, individual rights, et cetera. And we need to secure our purchase on everything that all the good stuff that came out of the Enlightenment and get to some kind of operating system culturally that is universalizable. I mean, we can celebrate the beautiful differences among cultures. I mean, it's not that I want all the food in every restaurant to be the same. I'm a xenophile in every cultural respect. But not with respect to the basic values that organize our ethical intuitions and the political system in which we live, right? So the rights, the rights of women and girls to get educated. I mean, that's not on the table to be rethought, right? Defense of slavery is not something that we need to entertain.
No.
And yet some cultures haven't figured that out, and so we have a genuine problem with them. But I view the predicament of Jews at this moment as a bit of a high wire act because, and needless to say, most Jews don't agree with me. I really think that doubling down on Jewish identity politics is a profound mistake as an endgame here in response to rising anti-Semitism. And I'm wondering if you have any intuitions about that.
I know what you mean. That's a tough requirement, though, because it's natural to most human beings to seek a sense of the tribe and the warmth of identity. My idea with anti-Semitism, once again, it's white on black. That's the way most people think of it. And I think the most important thing is that people have a richer sense of what the history of that situation was. And the challenge is that it was complex and there was a lot of it. And most people, whatever their political passions, are not going to be inclined to keep all of those facts and years and phenomena in their heads. And of course, Israel did some things during the whole time that, no nation would be proud of. Soldiers are rarely always fair, etc. But for the most part, I think the idea that Israel is this white country imposed by large white nations in a place where there were virtually no Jewish people before, they didn't have a history there, they had no right to have that as their homeland. I think most people, if you could sit them down and there's a requirement that they not talk for a half hour and put them through a lesson and then answer their questions and anticipate the usual objections. I think many people might have a different view, but you can't actually do that. but the history needs to be taught differently. I think we all know the meme that a lot of the student protesters really didn't know anything about Israel or Palestine. It was just a matter of protesting white power. And this is including the white protesters.
Yeah.
So there's that. But the other thing, Sam, though, is that, as I'm sure you know, for many people these days, the sort of peak wokists who aren't going to let it go, the idea that the Enlightenment was sacred, that doesn't work either. And so they wrap their heads around an idea that strictly rational thinking, sequential reasoning, all of that is white, and it's an imposition upon quote-unquote other modes of thinking. And of course, none of them can tell you anything significant that's been invented by these other modes of thinking.
Yeah.
But the
yeah.
idea is that you're not supposed to ask questions. And so you get things like a brilliant black physicist who, you know, wrote a widely read article arguing that physics should not be about white empiricism. Now, of course, what are you going to discover if you're just going to go by your black woman instincts about astrophysics? Nothing. But of course, she isn't asked that kind of question. So I agree with you. Yes, there are societies that haven't gotten the memo that women should not have to be covered up and should have education. But there's a certain kind of person who would never think of telling those societies that. And in fact, romanticize those societies as on some level more genuine and more in touch with themselves than ours.
Mm.
And I hope that, that John Walker Lind idea is not especially widespread. But yes, the Enlightenment was sacred. And one of the components of high wokeness is that it wasn't.
I can't imagine there's much regard for John Walker Lind in this world. I mean, if ever there were an act of cultural appropriation, is John Walker Lind going to fight with the Taliban from Marin County or wherever he came from? So are there any views that you have fundamentally changed your mind on in recent years? Can you think of any anything that has really blown you around and reformatted your intuitions about something of interest?
Like having a real change of heart.
Yeah.
Not about anything seismically important. But I used to be a big believer in the idea that black kids can learn alongside other black kids. And the idea that we have to think about desegregation as so very urgent is an easy mistake. I thought there were plenty of black students who excelled in all black schools in the bad old days. And there's no reason why that couldn't happen now. So the idea that you have to bus people, the idea that it's significant that black kids have that there be diversity in classrooms, et cetera, and which is a euphemism for black kids need to be around other white kids to excel. I didn't like that. And interestingly, you know, Zora Neale Hurston, the black author, she didn't like that. I didn't feel like I was unblack by feeling that way. But, you know, there have been so many studies now that show that mixing kids, especially by class, not only by color, but by class, that it does improve black student performance for various reasons. And so there's that. And vouchers, I've been in the business long enough now that vouchers were the hot thing for we contrarian people when I started writing about these things in 2000. That hasn't shown to really help much. And I wish it had, but it didn't. And so I don't write about vouchers or espouse vouchers anymore. Those are some things. I think if you don't change your views on some things, then you're not paying attention. Mm. You know, nobody is getting everything right all the time. But my general idea, well, social media changed something. If you had asked me in 2008, are we on our way to getting past race, especially when Obama was elected, I thought, yeah, I'm coming into this at a time when we are really on our way to getting away from a time I consider crucial in America's race story, the late 60s and the early 70s, when the new idea was that advocacy and action when it comes to race is about performance and theater and rhetoric rather than actually doing things on the ground. I think that the whole civil rights movement lost its sense of what it needed to do. And so you think about, you know, after 1968, the Fair Housing Act, i.e. the Anti-Redlining Act, what happened in the 70s that helped black people? Very hard to think of anything. And if you can, it's probably something that only a pointy-headed politico would think about, and it only had so much effect. Everything stopped. And I thought, you know, we are actually getting to the point where that's not a tragedy. Racism is lessening. People are mixing racially. It is becoming okay to be an educated white person and allow that racism is no longer the main factor holding many black people back. I thought that was going on. I thought we were having a more intelligent dialogue. Phones screwed that up. And so once you have phones doing what you mentioned before, stirring people up, showing pictures rather than giving text and creating new communities. It was two things. It was Trayvon Martin. Nobody would ever have heard of that beyond Florida. That would have been a 1-week story down there, if anything. if it weren't for phones. Not that it wasn't important to hear about it, but still. And then with Mike Brown and Ferguson, the idea that he died with his hands up in the air, which his friend told as a lie. Mm-hmm. But that still, many people don't know that that was disproven. If you're not a political junkie, you took your one snapshot of that. And many people think that that kid was shot in cold blood.
Yeah.
And that ruined it. And I'm not saying that Ta-Nehisi Coates did this on purpose, but his writing about that sort of thing and the fact that he could do it so well and him becoming the god that he became, it meant that America kept pretending on both sides. Shelby Steele's book of 1989, The Content of Our Character, where he says that Black people are afraid of freedom after the civil rights victories, and therefore exaggerate the amount of their victimhood and teach white people that they're monsters by not listening. And white people pretend to agree and everybody does a kind of a dance. That could be yesterday. And I wish that weren't true, because I thought we were getting past it in the Obama era, but we didn't, the phones.
So what you're describing there is not the persistence of, or the recrudescence of anti-Black racism.
No.
You're talking about the, just the continue, you know, the mincing of the problem such that it, so as to magnify it from on the left, right? Among yeah. activists and their students.
The idea that, yeah. you know, racism exists. It probably always will in various forms. But the idea that it's the Black community's main problem, I think, is grievously obsolete. That was yeah. true in the 60s, maybe into the 70s. And I think everybody deep down knows it. But we're still pretending, and it ends up discouraging innovative solutions to real problems.
So what do you do with this phenomenon of kind of guilt by association, which honestly, I've never known how to navigate, but to be kind of fairly conservative in who I'm willing to talk to. But I mean, there are many people who make precisely the same noises you just made or that I would make in this conversation, and yet they've also said something else that has gotten the attention of the censors and have been branded just a racist. Oh, the truth is, I've been branded. I was on the Southern Poverty Law Center website at one point. I'm not sure they called me a racist, but I mean, Ezra Klein effectively called me a
probably
racist.
Did.
So I'm no stranger to this. But what hasn't been done to me is something like what's been done to, and I don't even know how whether it's merited or not in her case. But like someone like Amy Wax is mm-hmm. treated as just, you know, she's just, you know, plutonium in certain mm-hmm. circles, and yet, you know, she would be nodding her head along with this conversation, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if she would add something incendiary to it that you and I wouldn't want to sign off on. But I know that, you know, for mm-hmm. instance, Glenn, you know, your colleague and friend, mm-hmm. has had, you know, profitable conversations with her. I mean, that's the only reason why I know her name, frankly, is having seen Glenn speak to her on multiple occasions.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, if you just go a tick right of her, you wind up in the, you know, some part of the white identitarian fever swamp with Jared
yeah.
Taylor or something mm-hmm. even more awful.
Who Amy Wax is invited to speak in her class.
Right.
Also.
And I don't know, you know, is that an interesting pedagogical moment or is that just some encroach of awfulness into, you know, where it shouldn't be in an Ivy League institution? So anyway, give me your reaction to that, because I just don't, honestly, I don't know how to kind of follow these breadcrumbs and not suddenly wind up in company I don't want to be in on some level.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I am warier about that than Glenn. And some people could accuse me of being too interested in my brand or something like that. And I'll say, yes, yeah, I accept that. Amy Wax is someone I used to know, but it became clear to me that she does believe, and I think that if she was sitting right here, in a way, she'd agree, she believes that Black people are mentally inferior. That is something she believes. Now, I think she also believes that there are cultural traits that some Americans have, and that many Black Americans would be included, that are not constructive to society. But there's also, it's clear that she considers there to be just an inherent inferiority. She never comes right out and says it the way Jared Taylor does, but it's what she believes. And as far as I'm concerned, that doesn't make her a psychopath. And more to the point, she should not be fired from UPenn for expressing her views. She does it clearly. She does it provocatively, which is a lot of why I steer clear from her. It's one thing to say those things, and that's one thing, but it's another thing to say it in the almost mocking tones that she often does, because that's as much a part of communication as the literal content. Bringing Jared Taylor in, to be honest, that's educational. There was a guy a lot like him when I was at Rutgers in college who would actually come and stand in the middle of campus and preach. He was this weird preacher who, you know, didn't like gay people. I don't remember him saying anything about race, but I can guess what he thought about race. And I learned. I thought, okay, there's some people who make this kind of argument. And it didn't hurt my feelings. And I think the idea that Amy Wax shouldn't be allowed to teach at UPenn is casting Black students as delicate flowers. I don't think that Black people are that delicate. And I don't like the idea of encouraging 22-year-olds to pretend that they are that delicate. Mm. They can take it. Life's hard. But once it gets to somebody who clearly believes there's an inferiority that means it should affect our policy, i.e. our whole sense of wanting to help is misguided because the people just aren't up to doing what we're asking. And for all of that to be delivered in mocking tones, for me, I have to steer clear of that. And maybe it's for a small reason, but when I started doing this, it was thought that I was a Republican conservative who didn't like Black people. And that was partly because I did work for the Manhattan Institute for a good while. And they are a Republican think tank. I was a Democrat among them. Mm-hmm. I did not join in any of the kind of rhetoric that one might have expected. But people thought that partly because I worked there. And I think partly because I was classified as a Black conservative because I thought affirmative action now needed to be based on class. But that in Black ideology means you're conservative. And then I have a starchy demeanor. I seem like I'm a Republican because I don't talk the way Ta-Nehisi Coates talks, et cetera. And so a lot of people thought that, and it meant that it was harder to get my message out. It was harder, not that I ever lacked opportunities for writing, but the people who wanted me were often ones who I did not feel that good being in bed with. And even when I was working, you know, with mainstream organs, they often thought that they were bringing me in as, say, the person who was going to vote for John McCain. Good man, but I was an Obama fan, and that confused so many Black editors. So I like that as time has passed, people see that I'm just, as I put it somewhere, a cranky liberal, and you might disagree with me, but I'm not a Republican right-winger. And I want to make sure that people understand that because then my message gets out more widely. The New York Times hires me. They wouldn't have hired me if I were this cranky Republican hack. Mm. So I am very careful. I was invited to do Tucker Carlson. I wouldn't be caught dead. I don't want anybody thinking that that is my brand. And that's a little fussy, I know, but I am a little fussy. No,
that's just the right kind of fussy.
He's
done a tremendous amount of harm, and he's not, I mean, it's incredible that the people who can't figure out, and I guess Glenn is one of them, just how non-compos mentis he is as an interlocutor.
Glenn feels that everybody should be given their exposure, everybody should be communicated with. Mm. And I kind of get that, but I just can't be that clinical about some people, and that would include Carlson.
What does your background as a linguist bring to your kind of cultural analysis? Is there something that the tools you have academically, does it give you a different point of purchase on the kinds of problems we've been talking about?
A little. I used to say that really the two things are just completely separate halves of my brain. But no, there is a little. It's hard to know this if you don't happen to be a linguist, but linguistics is not about word etymologies or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Linguistics is a science, really, depending on what kind of linguistics you do. But you're figuring out what, say, the one factor is that makes it so that a bunch of things like these irregular verbs and that you have to put this word in this part of the sentence instead of the other, all these disparate things all actually make sense if you understand that there's this one string you pull and everything comes together. You're looking for explanations. And it's called the problem-solving frame of mind. And I was trained in that. And I think I apply that to race sometimes too. And so, for example, Ta-Nehisi Coates did his piece on reparations in The Atlantic. It was well written. And I thought, okay, there goes that. And then there was this response to it as if it was, you know, Moses off of the Mount. And I wasn't jealous. You know, I didn't, back then, I never thought I would write for The Atlantic or anything like that and wasn't trying to. But I just thought, why are people responding to this article in that way? And I thought, you know, reparations in 2014, we had been through it in 2000 and 2001, which felt like 10 minutes ago, Randall Robinson's book, et cetera. There was a time when if you were a race person in the media, what you mainly talked about 2 years was reparations. And now here, 10 minutes later, he writes this piece, and there are people on Twitter talking about how they came away from it crying. And I just thought, to be honest, I think some people would think, these people are crazy. But no, they're not crazy. A lot of it were, they were serious public intellectuals. And I thought, what would make somebody have that emotional response to this piece about something that's been rather amply discussed? And I really had to think about it, because I was thinking, I'm missing something here. And it's not just that I'm unsentimental. It's not just that I'm not black enough. What is this? And that was when I thought, oh, wait a minute. They're not reading it for the facts. They're not reading it to learn something. They're listening to a sermon. That was when I came to my idea that, wait a minute, this what was soon going to be called wokeness was kind of an alternate Christianity. I thought, what they love is hearing something they already knew said beautifully by a person of authority. It's exactly as if they went to church on Sunday. And that made so much make sense to me in terms of people's responses to certain writers and, you know, the way they said it as opposed to what they said. And it was just like pulling the string, and then all of a sudden, everything makes sense. That was linguist me, and that was the last thing I was thinking at the time. But as I look back, I realize I'm always trying to see what's the one thing. And now my nattering on about battling power differentials, instead of everybody's going crazy. There are these people protesting about Gaza. There are these people going down on their knees in front of black people about George Floyd. What is all this? And I'm thinking it's all the same thing. That's a linguist's thinking. Mm. But it's taken me a while to realize that.
What is your linguist... view of the world reveal about the, I guess, the speech of President Trump? I mean, how when you listen to him, how can you explain the disparity in response from, I mean, I think you can well imagine how he strikes me most of the time, but there obviously there are tens of millions of Americans who find him deeply persuasive. So do you understand that?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What's happening there?
Trump is following up. I don't think on purpose, because I don't think he does much on purpose except hate and despise, but he's following up on a loosening up of our linguistic culture, which really starts in the 60s, but then especially over the past 25 years, it has become ordinary to use more ordinary speech in formal circumstances. And so George W. was a wonderful example, although his father had shown signs of it. And then the way Sarah Palin talked, that further normalized bar stool speech as something that you see somebody doing on TV.
I got to say, and though, John, there's been some serious atrophy, at least in my perception of all this. I was recently shown a clip of George W. Bush talking about something, and he sounded like Winston Churchill. I mean, honestly, it was unbelievable.
Yes, it's ever more extreme. But many people think that Trump's speech is some kind of decline from what he used to do. I think that that kind of tight-cheeked 80s Trump that we see in these old clips, he was trying harder then because he was trying to crack the elite and he was more self-conscious when giving public addresses. I think what he's doing now is just what he's always been, which is, you know, he's probably always talked like Archie Bunker. And he just knows now that he can get away with it because, and this is the second part, he is very funny. Yeah. And I think he's the devil's spawn. But frankly, he is a funny man. He is a stand-up comic. And part of being a stand-up comic is you cannot speak formally. And so he's got this swivel-tongued way of talking. And it's a great vehicle for stand-up comedy smarts. Little Marco, you know, that's really stupid, but it's also funny. Yeah. And I think that a lot of the audience, a lot of his, notice I say audience rather than voters, you know, if you're not that into politics, you just like the cut of his jib. And he's that kind of swaggering camp counselor snapping a towel in the locker room. That's him. And so I can see how many people don't mind that he can't rub a noun and a verb together. Now, to tell you the truth, say the past 3 or 4 weeks, something's going on. I think it's even slurrier and sloppier than it used to be. Everything is kofefe at this point. I feel like he's either slowing down or there's something more specific wrong. But in terms of how he spoke last summer, that was just... it was great Rodney Dangerfield, to tell you the truth. Dangerfield was better, but it's water from the same well.
But what do you do with the degree to which that his fans obviously relax their standards of coherence? And I mean, he can contradict himself within the span of 30 seconds, and his fans don't really care. He's just like kind of creating a vibe. And I mean, he's quite literally speaking out of both sides of his mouth. You can't possibly know what he actually meant because he said A and he said B and they're irreconcilable. And it doesn't matter. I feel like most other public figures aren't given the same latitude.
They aren't.
Even from the same audience.
Yeah, they aren't. I mean, I think he's processed as an entertainer. He's processed as a near god by many. And I know enough Trump voters and have like listened, heard them out enough to know that a lot of it is they figure whatever addle-pated stuff he says, he is going to protect them rather than mess with things going on elsewhere. Now, of course, that doesn't seem to be at all what he does either, but they think that's what he's going to do. That's what he's all about. And so, yeah, it's very different today. I mean, the truth is, we forget this because we just don't see as much of it. Eisenhower was known as making speeches where nothing like Trump, but kind of not really saying anything. Mm-hmm. There were stand-up comics who would do him doing that. People aren't as demanding of presidential oratory as we often think, or they haven't been in a very long time. But clearly, this is new, and it's getting weirder and weirder. I mean, just right now, this, what is it being called? The fuck with us and find out. Fuck around and find out. The idea that a president would be connected to that slogan with that word.
Yeah.
We're in a new era, but it doesn't really surprise me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the official White House Twitter feed, the official White House website is basically a place where you find, you know, poop emojis and just the memes of, effectively 4chan.
We're in an era where informality reigns. And I think a lot of these guys and women are just basically part of their time, and they get it from one another, and they see that it's allowed from on high. And I try to pay more attention to the substance, but yes, there's a certain blockheaded quality to it.
Doesn't informality or a certain degree of lack of decorum become substance, though? I mean, I feel like this is a point that, you know, Orwell, or at least been attributed to Orwell, you know, civility, decorum, manners, these are bulwarks against violence, right? I mean, to have a president who will just shitpost his rival, political rivals, or even ordinary citizens, there's something, I mean, it does rally the mob. I mean, to say nothing of the fact that he actually calls for some people to be hung. I mean, he recently called for members of Congress to be hung for sedition. I mean, that's obviously crossing several Rubicons that we wouldn't want to cross politically. But short of that, just the unraveling of decorum across the board, where there's just like every last verbal stop of decency has been passed. And really, ironically, it does kind of come back to a raw appeal to power in the end. It's just like, I can say this, I can tell you to fuck yourself every which way, and in ways that you wouldn't imagine a representative of any public institution with a history would do. And there's nothing you can do about it. And the acquiescence to this by all of his allies becomes a kind of loyalty test for them. It's like, oh yeah, we didn't care about our image at all, you know, here in Congress, and we don't care about any of the norms that, you know, we would have been astonished if anyone broke them prior to this. But now that he's breaking them, and we're in this personality cult, the only way, really, all we can do is just kind of double down and coarsen everything all at once.
You know, Sam, here's more linguist me though. I think we have to be open to the idea, because like when a language changes, when a word comes or a word goes, when something goes irregular, you always have to have an element of chance built into your model. And that seems like giving up, but anything interesting is partly driven by contingency and chance. And I hope it's an intelligent hope with Trump and the vulgarity, the threats of violence. He is doing these things as somebody who is, I think, my analysis, is nothing but id. I think Trump does very little sitting and reflecting and making a plan. He just does stuff. And that includes that he writes these horrible tweets late at night because he can't sleep and he's angry about something somebody said about him. And, you know, he's not a man of words in any real way. And so he gets more and more extreme and pushing his ideas with the capital letters and the silly quotation marks and stuff, and now calling for people to be killed. And he's going to keep doing that. But, you know, James Comey, in a way, not to mention maybe sexism, was why he won against Hillary Clinton. He could have not won then.
Yeah.
Then this time, almost certainly, he won partly, or at least largely, because Joe Biden was asleep.
Yeah.
He happened to get lucky both times. I don't know if he's establishing a new norm. Even if Vance ended up being president, which I don't think he will, except unless Trump doesn't make it through office. But I think a Vance presidency would involve much less of this. I think that we happen to have a clown car cabinet right now because the president is a clown. But he won't be there forever. And I can't see who else would come in other than maybe Hegseth, and you know that's not going to happen as president, who would preside over the same sort of atmosphere. I think we may be seeing a temporary detour. We've seen it twice. I have hope that the next president would be different. But
yeah, so the kind of kayfabe approach that we see with Trump is something that you don't think anyone else could properly enact in that role?
I think he is a black swan. I think that it's the decay of the Republican Party such that he could even get as far as he did. But I think that he was an unusual thing, not the beginning of the future.
Mm.
That's my sense of it.
Well, I hope President Tucker Carlson doesn't prove you wrong. Oh, my God.
See, that's not going to happen. But yeah, there could be people who would continue this tradition, but I don't think it's at all necessary that that's what would happen. So we just have to see.
Do you spend much time thinking about or reacting to conspiracy theories?
No.
No?
It's not that some of them don't have some truth to them, but no, because they almost always involve too many people too uniquely able to keep a secret for too long. So no, I don't.
But why do you think that isn't obvious to more people? I mean, like the fact that this lack of appetite for conspiracy thinking that I think you and I share, why isn't that more common?
Oh, well, that's because there's a linguist in everybody to an extent, in that all human beings want to have a sense that they've got it all solved. It's a good feeling. They're endorphins, where you think, oh, it's all this separate stuff that I have to keep in my head. Oh, no, it's all just variations on the same thing. And so that's why Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster, et cetera. It gives you a sense of having figured something out. I think we're probably genetically programmed to find a certain pleasure in doing that. And with the conspiracy theories, it's always easy. You know, there's always some, you know, cartoon villain, some silly idea about pizza in the basement. And so that's people trying to be smart. I completely understand that.
Have you seen how much Candace Owens has figured out of late?
She's the genuine article. I think she really does sit just trying to stir up the pod and watching everybody jump. That, or I hate to say this. I don't know her. I don't know her people. I've never been in a room with her. And, you know, it's not good when a man says this about a woman, but sometimes when I see her racing by my media feeds, I think, is she really just highly unintelligent? Like, if she believes these sorts of things, can she not reason from A to B? But I get the feeling she's a performer. But, wow. Yeah, I wouldn't want to have dinner with her.
Yeah, it's strange. I don't have a theory of mind for her. I don't know if she's
me either.
Crazy. She's certainly very intelligent in a certain way. I mean, she's a great performer. I mean, she's verbally dexterous and
more deliberation than Trump. Yeah.
But she's, I don't know if she's crazy or dumb in precisely the way you need to be dumb to believe each next unvetted thought that comes careening into your brain. But yeah, I don't know if she's sincere in to any degree or if she just has found this amazing piece of performance art that she can just keep manifesting.
You can see that way of thinking, you know, on all parts of the spectrum. And so the woke idea that you often hear, even from white people are devoted to preserving their power. And they go into the voting booth wanting to preserve the power of whiteness. They won't let it go. Mm. That's a grand old line since the 60s. Everybody knows that doesn't make any sense. You know, there's a white woman at the supermarket with her kid in the shopping cart. Is that woman holding on to the power of whiteness? No. But it feels so good to think that you have figured that grand thing out. That's the woke version of Candace Owens and her sense of Jewish people and everything.
What are
else.
All those woke people on precisely that point? What would they say if you pointed out the two terms of Barack Obama's presidency and all the white people who had tears in their eyes, at least the first time around when he got elected?
Mm-hmm. And the quick answer is then look who came in after that. And so Donald Trump was white people going back to the way they really are. And a crucial number of white people didn't like that a black man was president, and therefore they elected Donald Trump. I think that's Ta-Nehisi Coates' idea, although I must admit I didn't actually read the article that seemed titled as if he was going to say something like that, so I could be wrong. But yeah, so, and of course, that's highly counterintuitive. All those white people with tears in their eyes, all those white people who voted this black man in twice, including when he was running against the whitest, most Disney perfect Republican in the world. And yet Barack Obama won again and by a lot. But yet there's always some sort of messy explanation because I hate to say, many people who are driven by that kind of thinking, they're trying to be systematic, but they're not always used to dealing with counter evidence. They don't know that somebody might make an argument against. I remember a guy who, he was a 9/11 truther, and he had all these ideas about the conspiracy that must have been involved and how there's no way the buildings could have burned down. And whenever I would tell him, well, actually, science shows this. Well, actually, don't you realize that doesn't make sense, et cetera. It rattled him. He was very intelligent, but he wasn't used to spending time with anybody who didn't think like him. And it frustrated him that anybody wouldn't just say, oh, okay. To be able to go to that second level and realize that something that feels good in your gut still might not be true and that you might have to concede, that's not easy for human beings. And so that's where you get, I've never had an argument with Candace Owens, but I can guess that's how it would go.
I have a heuristic that I would want to recommend to any Democratic politician at this point, and tell me if you think this overstates the case, but my gut instinct here is that almost any mention of race in any context for any reason is almost always counterproductive at this point, right? Now, obviously, all those qualifiers of almost leave some room for exceptions, but generally speaking, I think we should simply not put race as a filter on any political question going forward.
Yes, see, talk about working against your gut instincts. My gut tells me that we're not supposed to do that. However, I see where you're going with that. I'm increasingly inclined to say that we need to think more about class.
Yeah.
And that's especially given that, you know, nowadays we talk about the underclass. It used to be that you thought about a black ghetto, but now it's also, you know, hillbilly elegy, et cetera. Mm. And we can't pretend that isn't true. Not to mention that we talk about race as if it was 1970 when, and this is vastly oversimplified, but because there was a block on immigration for the most part in this country, except for certain small groups. From 1924 to 1965, all there was white and black. There were some Latinos on the side. You knew one Chinese person, but it was just white and black. Ever since the Immigration Act of 1965, things are just so different. And so the whole dialogue about race, where what we mean by race really is black people and sometimes Latinos, it just doesn't fit with the times anymore. And to the extent that there, you can call something a microaggression. These things are there. But the question is, do they matter enough for us to be basing policy or analyzing elections or trying to set up elections on the basis of them? What are black voter concerns? You know, what exactly does that mean, especially given the diversity among black people in the country? So, yeah, I could go with you on that. I'm beginning to move in that direction, but it's hard because even, you know, contrarian me feels like there's a certain, you don't go beyond a certain point that race is always a reality. You just have to grapple with what kind of reality and rebut the arguments that don't fit with yours. To say we need to get past it, I'm getting there. Yeah.
All right, John, finally, just what are you working on now? What's going to claim your attention, or at least what you hope will claim your attention in 2026?
The next book is going to be about dialects of American English, because I think that the reading public needs a book about that, that frankly, that I write. I want to do it my way. In terms of looking at the country in general, I'm not just saying this because of the question you just asked, but Glenn and I have been talking about this. Quote unquote, is race over? And if so, where do you go from there? That really is a very important question right now. To be having the old school kinds of discussions is beginning to get a little tired. Glenn and I both, you know, are tired of it, and we realize that the country maybe has moved on. And, you know, at 60, I refuse to ever feel old, but, you know, I've now been an adult, a real adult for over 40 years. It's been a while, and what I think of as the norm was forged in, like, 1980.
Mm-hmm.
That's now 46 years ago. So, yeah, that is something that I think is going to shape some of the things that I write or say as we move along in 2020.
Yeah, well, having teenagers is instructive, isn't it?
It is, because you realize it's a revelation.
Yeah, the teaching goes both ways.
It does. And you can see that as they're becoming mature people, they're seeing a different world than anything you knew when you were that age. Mm. And you just realize that you have to learn to adjust. It's very educational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sean McWhorter, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Sam. Thank you very much.